Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. You can watch today's video stream by going to Ustream channel and looking for Gary Null. Also, today we're going to talk about research proving common viruses can lead to cancer. All right, why is that important? What can we do about it? Cats, give them coconut oil, some good things happen. And a high-fat diet leads to overeating because of faulty brain signaling, something new. And then we're going to compare, in this particular study from the University of Minnesota, beef versus beans, when it comes to filling full. Because one of the excuses meat eaters have given is, I can eat all that vegetable stuff in the world, I don't feel satisfied. Really? We'll take a look at that and show you what the latest study shows. Also today, the guest in the second part of my program will be Professor Lisa Miller. She is a professor of clinical psychology and director of the clinical psychology at Columbia University's Teachers College. We're going to talk about the science behind the innate spiritual nature of children and how spirituality promotes healthy adolescence. Also, I'll be doing a commentary today on the Pope's visit. I thought it would be appropriate since I've heard so many comments and I watched all the comments being shared on Fox last night. Not surprising, so I'll offer a counterbalance. Also today, I'm sure some of you have heard that a pharmaceutical company was purchased by some young billionaire, and immediately he changed the price of a very important drug, a life-saving drug, from around $11 or $12 a pill to $700 a pill. Why did he do it? Profit. Lots of money. We're going to have an audio clip today about Martin, this farmer bro. He isn't the only one hiking up prescription drug prices to make a profit. It's been going on a long time. Also, when we see the plight of the Syrian refugees and we see how they're treated, more often than not, with incredible disrespect for the quality of their life, did you know that Syria has a long history of opening its borders to strangers? We'll talk about that. Also, organic food, it's going up in volume. And the nuclear industry's ongoing cancer cover-up. We'll share that with you. Also, word from medical students. They're saying, stop this nonsense of having people go bankrupt because they can't afford medicines or medical care. Have a single payer. Now, mind you, you have over 920,000 physicians. They have not come out once as a major group protesting anything that's wrong in medicine. Last year, a small handful said, gee whiz, we're oncologists and there's just too much money being made at the cost of the patient when it comes to these drugs. Yeah. And what have you done to stop it? How about nothing? But what about all the other procedures? What about paying $100 for a bag of saline that cost under $1 to produce? We have to take the profit out of our healthcare system. In fact, I'm doing a major documentary on that topic as we speak. Also today, if time permits, I'm going to talk about the five obstacles on the spiritual path. Wes Anak from Wake Up World. We have a lot to share. Let's begin. First and foremost, we have a lot of viruses in the body, and not all these viruses do us harm. Some do, especially when our immune system is weakened. That's also true of bacteria. So the key is the immune system. As long as your immune system is strong, as long as you are eating right, we're getting rest, and have less stress, exercising, you'll be able to handle most of the bacteria and viruses you come in contact with. It's when your immune system falters, it's when you get tired, it's when you take your problems to bed with you and don't get a good night's sleep, it's when you start looking for the comfort food that is not healthy, your immune system goes down. Then those viruses make a difference. This is the latest news. When someone speaks about a virus, most people associate it with the common cold or flu or other illnesses, which is generally what? It's over in a day, 3 days, a week. Viruses are such small organisms that an ordinary microscope would not be able to detect them. With millions of distinct types of viruses, each survives by entering and inserting its own DNA or RNA into a living cell. It is then able to reproduce and push the cell toward a cancerous condition. Now, two very common viruses will infect the majority of society sometime in the lifetime. In fact, research has shown that one of the viruses will infect 95% of the American population at a young age. The virus lies dormant as a silent killer just waiting to attack. It's the Epstein-Barr virus. That's according to the CDC. 95% of adults are infected with the Epstein-Barr virus by the age of 40. The virus is best known for causing infectious mononucleosis, which is often referred to as mono, or the kissing virus. Epstein-Barr is highly contagious and can be passed from person to person by sneezing, coughing, even sharing silverware in a home. It's easy to get infected with it. Now, while the Epstein-Barr virus does not cause serious problems in most people, it stays dormant in certain white blood cells in the body called B lymphocytes or B cells. However, very recent studies published in the peer-reviewed journal Expert Reviews in Molecular Medicine, as well as Clinical and Translational Oncology, proves the virus increases a person's risk of a particular type of cancer. Once it was considered a rare type of cancer affecting the head and neck, it's increasing in numbers. Plus, a related matter, recent ongoing studies have shown that Epstein-Barr is associated with a lymphogenesis, and Burkitt's and Hodgkin's lymphoma are both affected by the virus. Now, the traditional medical community has determined there's no cure for Epstein-Barr virus. However, I would challenge that. Having worked with tens of thousands of individuals, both professionally as the person creating the protocols at the Tri-State Healing Center for all the more than 14 physicians and licensed healthcare practitioners that treated thousands of people, we would have regular blood taken and see the results before and after. Now, here's the key. You will not kill the Epstein-Barr virus with low doses of vitamin C or intravenous vitamin drips or vitamin A. But when I saw people who had very high Epstein-Barr virus, who had full-blown cases of, chronic fatigue syndrome, or who had different cancers and had very high titers of Epstein-Barr, by putting them on an extremely high protocol, medically supervised, of course, with regular blood workup testing, we were able to see those blood markers come down to virtually non-existent. There was only the marker in the body, the antibody, which showed that you had once been infected, and you will always have that. That's actually a good thing. It means the body recognizes the virus or the bacteria and has created an antibody against it, but the actual active virus is gone. Now, I was able to do that with HIV. In fact, those cases were brought to the attention of Tony Brown, I was told, by Arthur Ashe. Arthur, by the way, there were several people within the African-American community who visited the center. Bill Tatum, the Amsterdam News Publisher. There's Stokely Carmichael, a lot of people, some I will not mention because they didn't go public, but these people went public. In fact, two of them came up to Harlem when I was lecturing at the Apollo Theater for a week every day and gave evidence. Arthur was one of them. Arthur was kind of in a predicament, though. On the one hand, he had been made aware of the good work by an outstanding reporter, Doug Henderson, and Doug worked as one of our scholars in residence. He was also an attorney and went back to doing his legal work after 4 years. We were very gifted in having him on staff. But anyhow, Arthur shows up, and normally someone comes, they might come for an hour or 2 hours, have a conversation. But for a period of years, my policy was, if you want to do your homework, come and really do homework. Come in and spend hours. With the patient's approval, review their records. Look at all their blood workups. Interview the physicians. And most importantly, come back and see how that patient do. When I saw them 6 months ago, a year ago, are they alive? Are they not? Now, considering we were dealing with life-threatening illnesses, it's important to know that. To his credit, Arthur was there frequently, spending long periods of time, engrossed in very detailed conversation, and trying to see for himself, did it work? And one night, he says to me, I've looked at dozens of records. I've interviewed hundreds of people. I'm absolutely convinced. Why isn't this being known? And I said, simple. One, it is not a part of the established paradigm. And I don't take it personally. It's not me or this medical staff. Nowhere in America could you offer a therapy that was beneficial to the patient and non-toxic and not expensive and have it accepted. Because, two, it threatens a financial, the entire financial paradigm is based upon having certain protocols for cancer, for AIDS. They won't look at the hundreds of thousands of people died using their approved and promoted drugs. They'll say it was the virus that killed them. The person gets sick, they increase the amount of the drug. And I said, but here are people whose frequently their partners died taking high levels of the anti-AIDS drugs, and they saw their partner go from infected but healthy to joining these support groups that promoted the drugs, to being badgered not to try anything natural alternative, to trying the drugs at higher doses, and then they get sicker and sicker. The doctor continues to give them more drugs. They get sicker and more drugs and sicker and more drugs, just like chemotherapy, until the patient dies. Never once, not a single person in that whole community saying, you know something, maybe we have it wrong. Instead, just like heart disease, just like cancer, just like depression, just like everything else, it's more of the same. So unenlightened. So Arthur saw this. And then next thing I know, I get a call from Tony Brown saying, we heard you, you're doing some good work with people and getting good results. And I said, well, they're alive and well and improving, but a group of them, eight that went on a very extreme protocol, they were here 5 days a week for 4 hours a day. What'd that cost them? Cost them nothing. I paid for it, not a penny. In fact, 50% of all the patients never paid a penny. They got free treatment. And we're talking about thousands of patients. And look for yourself. And he did. Months went by. Next thing you know, these people were invited to go on the air on PBS. And they have a very strict vetting system. You would think that if you have eight people who have all improved or reversed their AIDS condition, including HIV negative from HIV positive, that someone would find that of interest. To the contrary, the more the results using natural non-toxic treatments, the more they resented it. So in that period, there were very high doses of vitamin A, aqueous vitamin A, meaning it wasn't toxic to the liver, vitamin D3, vitamin C, and that's when we saw the destruction of the Epstein-Barr viruses. Gone. And so the idea was, would it work? And it was working in breast cancer, it was working in ovarian cancer, prostate cancer, full spectrum. So it's just to let you know, when they say there's no cure, they're right. But they haven't done the protocols we've done. So, what do? You build up your immune system. You build up your immune system so that your immune system's able to take care of these and destroy them. And that's entirely doable. But not if you have a weakened immune system and you're tired, you're not getting rest, and you're stressed, and you're nutritionally imbalanced, and you have nutrition deficiencies. Then those viruses can go from dormant to awakening, and that's when people get very sick. So keep your immune system strong. Now let's say you have a cat. Now this is important because the Journal of the American Veterinary and Medical Association published an article in volume 247, number 4, pages 365. It was a study of two trials. They used 30 cats were allowed to consume certain things, and they found that the coconut oil and supplements caused the cats to lose weight but keep what was important, their lean body mass. Now, why is this important? Because coconut oil helps humans. I recommend coconut oil for so many conditions, topically for your skin, massaging it in. Combine coconut oil and olive oil, a teaspoon of both, massage it in your hands, massage it into your scalp at night. And it's one of the best things in the world you can do. In fact, if you went to Italy and Spain, it's very common for them to massage extra virgin olive oil into the scalp at night. And it helps. It's terrific for your scalp and your hair. In any case, for cats, when your cat gets fat, you've shortened its lifespan. When I was in Italy last, I was in the country talking with farmers, and you would see cats and dogs, and in the normal conversation, you ask them, how old's your cat? Oh, she's 27. 27. 25-year-old dogs I saw. But they're not eating stuff out of boxes and cans. They're eating raw foods. They're eating healthy foods. They're eating clean foods and whole foods. And that's what we don't feed our cats and dogs in the United States. But give your cat coconut oil. It'll lose weight, live a longer life, be healthier. Now, a lot of people won't eat chili. I'm not talking about the chili as a meal. I'm talking about the chili peppers. It's too hot. They think something's wrong with it. To the contrary, that heat that you're feeling is not burning you. It's actually doing a lot of good. It's helping prevent a stroke, especially if you take one before you work out in the morning. And before you go to bed at night, you should always take some the cayenne capsule, the extra hot. It can help keep the blood the red blood cells from aggregating together and creating clots. Here's something else it does, and this was published in Cancer Weekly, the official magazine, and this study appears in the American Cancer Society's The Journal of Physical Chemistry B. Quote, capsaicin, the compound responsible for chili's heat, is used in creams sold to relieve pain, and recent research shows that in high doses, it kills prostate cancer cells. It kills prostate cancer cells. So, simple reasoning. If it's killing prostate cancer cells, why aren't we advocating it for all men over the age of 30 to take it to prevent cancer of the prostate? So, quote, about 10 years ago, researchers reported that capsaicin can kill prostate cancer cells in mice by leaving healthy cells unharmed, but translating that dose to humans would require them to eat a huge number of chili peppers each day. Figuring out how capsaicin works could help researchers figure out how the molecule binds to a cell surface and affects the membrane, which surrounds and protects the cell. That finding prompted a group of scientists to try to gain a deeper understanding of capsaicin's effects so it might be harnessed. And so now they figured out how it works and how it kills the cancer cells and does not harm the good cells. A high-fat diet leads to overeating because faulty brain signaling. This is from Vanderbilt University. It says, defective signaling in the brain can cause overeating of high-fat foods in this laboratory study, and the body controls food intake by balancing a need for food to survive with a desire for food for pleasure. By shifting the balance between these two systems, defective brain signaling can cause pleasure to take over, resulting in overeating and obesity. And this was done at the neuroscience program in substance abuse at Vanderbilt University. So, what does this mean? Well, it means that right now in the United States, we have the largest number of obese children, teenagers, and adults in our country's history. In fact, we are the fattest nation on the planet per population. Now, I would suggest that there are people who have so much chemical toxicity, what I call autotoxemia, that may be applied to them, meaning they are having such a desire for food because it helps lessen anxiety, it helps us with depression, it helps us when we're feeling uncomfortable or insecure. People eat. They eat comfort foods because it takes them back to a time in life when their mom gave them food as comfort. All right? But then that takes over, and then you change the signaling. So a one-month detoxification of the brain could help rebalance that, so then you don't desire those foods as often. In fact, you desire food for your survival and health, which makes more sense. So that's the good news on that. And I'll be giving you in the next week a 30-day brain rebalancing detoxification protocol on the air. It'll take me about a half hour. Good for all of these medical students. They're doing something that should have been done a long time ago. This is from Common Dreams, from Vanessa Van Doren. Quote, medical students protest private health insurance company greed and call for a single-payer healthcare system at a rally outside the offices of Blue Cross Blue Shield Illinois in Chicago last year. Students from at least 30 medical schools will hold teach-ins and rallies and candlelight vigils to remember the millions of Americans in the United States who remain uninsured, underinsured, or underserved by our current system, and will urge the swift adoption of an improved version of Medicare for all. For most of us in medicine, helping people live healthy, happy lives is at least at the heart of why we choose this career. We expound upon this in application essays, talk about it during interviews, and start medical school with this calling fresh in our minds. Very early on in our medical careers, on the wards in the classroom, we learned that inequality, preventable illness, and death are an inherent part of our current private for-profit oriented healthcare insurance system. We see patients receive preventable amputations due to untreated diabetes. We see people permanently disabled by stroke because they were unable to afford their medications. College funds emptied out to pay for $100,000 a year cancer treatments. Families bankrupted and lived lives destroyed. We learned that although the United States is one of the wealthiest countries on earth, we are also the only developed nation that does not provide health care to all of its citizens. We learned that we spend over 17% of our gross domestic product, more than any other country in the world, on this non-universal coverage. We learned that medical debt is the leading cause of bankruptcy in the United States. We learned that despite its title, the Affordable Care Act is not truly affordable. Even after the ACA, Affordable Care Act, tens of millions of people are still unable to afford insurance, and tens of thousands die every year because of uninsurance. Millions more have insurance, are underinsured, risking financial distress in the event of serious illness, and finding that their health policies, high deductibles, and copays prevent them from using it. All of this leads most reasonable medical students to ask, what can we do about this? Just as the problem is clearly mapped out, so is the solution. There is an excellent model for universal health care, one that covers everyone, leads to better health outcomes, and costs taxpayers far less than the current U.S. system. Implemented in dozens of countries around the world, including our next-door neighbor, Canada, the model is called single-payer health care. Implementing a single-payer healthcare in the United States would be far from revolutionary, as part of its fragmented multi-payer system, the U.S. already has a single-payer-like subdivision. We call it Medicare. It is efficient, cost-effective, and has stood the test of time, providing health insurance to all American seniors for the past 50 years. By improving and expanding Medicare to cover all Americans, we can use this existing infrastructure to achieve universal coverage, better health outcomes, and better physician working conditions. Medical students across the country have already joined the fight for universal single-payer care. Students for a national health program currently have 650 members in over 40 chapters across the country. And so on in this coming next Thursday, they will lead over 30 universities across the country to a Medicare for All National Day of Action. Great, we support that. So the website is 101medicare-4-all-national-day-of-action. Good for you for doing that. I'm glad to see it now. If we could get the 900,000-plus doctors to join you and the nurses, then we would pass this quickly. I'm Gary Nall, and a couple of other issues that are important. I'm concerned when part of medicine decides that it's okay to have a 5,000% increase in the markup over the generic cost of a 30-day supply of a drug. But that's chump change. So the meeting went crazy this week when there was a charge increase from $13.50 a pill to $750 for the same pill. Yes, there was shock and there was outrage. Toxoplasmosis is a parasitic disease, and it's when with people with weakened immune systems, and when you have it, like certain cancer patients, AIDS patients, unborn babies, they're very susceptible. Well, they jacked it up almost 5,000% overnight, and just to make money. And it's been around for 62 years. It's saved a lot of lives. And in fact, from the original owner, it was at $1 a pill. Then it went to $13 a pill. And then it went to, you know, $750 a pill, all for profit. Let's hear in a point of view on why Big Pharma is the worst.
The most hated man in the world right now may very well be Martin Shkreli. The 32-year-old pharmaceutical company bought a one-of-a-kind HIV and cancer treatment pill and hiked the price up by 5,000% for no other apparent reason than to make money. But then there was the backlash. Social media erupted, politicians denounced his practices, and Shkreli now has said he will lower the medication's price. Congrats, you guys. You stopped a greedy CEO. Done and done, right? Hardly. Maura Kalson, health policy director at the Center for American Progress, said price gouging in the pharmaceutical industry is a very common practice.
Right now, I think you're seeing a perfect storm. I think that this is just the latest example of what people are seeing as extraordinarily high costs that are becoming more and more out of control and less affordable.
After acquiring the rights to tuberculosis medication earlier this year, one company increased the price by more than 2,000%. And two separate life-saving heart medications went up in price this February by 525% and 212% per vial the same day they were bought by a new company. Oh, and our friend Martin Shkreli? He did the same thing for the last company he worked for, jacking up the price of kidney medication by 2,000%. When capitalism and life-saving meds combine. As you can imagine, Americans spend a lot on prescription drugs, $374 billion last year alone. And yet prices for crucial prescription medications continue to rise. So how can they get away with hiking up prices? Well, it's a lack of regulation. The FDA has no rules against price hikes, so companies can take advantage of owning the only drug on the market. This affects not only people who pay out of pocket, but hospitals and insurance companies too. And then there's the Big Pharma lobby, which happens to spend way more money on lobbying Congress than any other industry, which of course helps them profit even more. In 2003, they successfully lobbied Congress to deny Medicare the ability to negotiate drug prices. So Medicare, and in turn, all of us, pay more. Big Pharma is so lucrative, in fact, that companies like Pfizer can afford to pay billions in fines for promoting drugs that aren't approved as safe. And despite what CEOs like Shkreli say, companies often spend more on marketing their drugs than on research and development, sometimes twice as much.
If the status quo remains, it is a win for the pharmaceutical industry and it is a loss for consumers.
So what's being done? Well, some politicians have been working more strictly to regulate the pharma industry. Both Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton have presidential plans to regulate drug pricing. But Big Pharma isn't fazed. One CEO went on CNBC's Mad Money this week to say what he felt about government regulation.
All of our intelligence says that it's going to be very hard for Hillary or any other candidate to really have a profound impact on drug pricing.
He might be right about the candidates, but as Carlson told us, it's public opinion that could really have sway, especially since 73% of Americans think prescription drug prices are unreasonable. So, did the most hated man in the world finally get us talking about the Big Pharma problem?
Keep in mind, here's what was not said. Let's take a look at how it all works. It works first by having the pharmaceutical industry that makes more profit, the top pharmaceutical companies, the top 10, than the other Fortune 500 companies combined. And it's not that they're charging us a lot because they do all this research. They spend over $4 billion per year in lobbying. They don't even call it lobbyists anymore. It's consultants. And who are their primary consultants? Former legislative aides or legislators themselves. Let me give you one example. When it came to the government paying the highest possible prices instead of the least expensive generic versions for Medicaid and Medicare, but not VA, why didn't that happen? It could have saved at least $100 to $200 billion a year for the government, meaning we, the taxpayers. It's because a group of 11 people working together lobbied for this provision to protect the manufacturer's profits by not allowing the government to compete and find cheaper prices for the drugs, and they inserted that into a major bill. The bill was passed in the middle of the night. It was like 3 o'clock in the morning. Shortly thereafter, the person that lobbied for that left the House of Representatives and became one of the highest paid people in the history of the pharmaceutical industry by running its industry, rep group, its trade association. Every one of those people that lobbied on behalf of the bill got jobs today in Big Pharma. Dr. Gerberding, who ran the CDC and oversaw its safety vaccines, left the CDC to take on a job that thus far, at least minimally, has paid her $3 million because it was disclosed when she sold $1.6 million of her stock in Merck to head Merck's vaccine division. And now every one of the government agencies have revolving doors. So Big Pharma makes sure that its money is spread to first medical school curriculums. So what is taught to doctors is all a pharmaceutical approach. There's no holistic approach to medicine, so the doctor is limited in how they understand the nature of disease. They're not taught about what happens if you're not harmonizing your energy at home, the nature of your relationships, the epigenetics of how you were raised and your parental input and teacher input. It doesn't tell you about what happens if your unique biochemistry is different. Everybody gets the same food. Everybody gets the same portions of protein. Everybody gets the same vaccines. It doesn't show individuality and need of individual approaches in healthcare at all. It's the pharmaceutical approach or the mechanistic approach. Then they fund the advertising in medical and scientific magazines. They have an enormous amount of control over editorial content. Then they fund think tanks that take forward the argument that you shouldn't have any regulations in any industry. And these are the people that work at the federal level. But then they also fund ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, that protects the Big Pharma at the state level and regulations. And then they control the media. Look at 60 Minutes this coming Sunday evening and see how many ads are on there during that 1 hour. Then tell me the last time 60 Minutes went after Big Pharma. not a specific medical issue, but big pharma in general. Then ask the average doctor, what do you know about homeopathy, naturopathy, chiropractic, acupuncture, acupressure, massage, meditation, psychoneuroimmunology, sound and healing? Tell me what you know. And they know nothing. And hence, how can they possibly help in the prevention of illness if they're clueless about what causes it? And their whole argument that it's genetic is itself completely flawed. So that's why universal healthcare, with the addition of a whole new body of scientific-based healing and prevention, is needed at this time. Before we go to our guest who is standing by, I want you to hear one piece that you won't hear anywhere else, and that's about, with all the crisis for the refugees, we are not paying any attention as to what role we, the United States and our allies, played in causing regime change, or attempting it, Libya, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Iran, and how that caused the problems. And so they're arguing about the value of taking in refugees. But what about Syria taking in refugees historically?
Syrians make up the largest number of refugees in the world. The world, though, hasn't been too welcoming to them. Ironic when you look at Syria's history with other refugees. Thousands of Circassians fleeing a Russian invasion made new homes in Syria. Armenians fleeing mass killings in Turkey resettled in Syria in large numbers. And in 1948 and 1967, Palestinians escaping Israeli wars and occupation crossed into Syria. Syria has also taken in refugees fleeing war in various other countries. More recently, when the U.S. invaded Iraq, thousands of Iraqis found refuge across the border. 3 years later, Syrians welcomed Lebanese escaping the war with Israel. Can the world learn something from Syria's hospitality?
Also, next week I'll be doing a special report on the truth behind Benghazi, the report that has not been done by any media, alternative or mainstream. Also, I'll tell you, why did they want regime change in Syria? Did it happen to do with the family? No. That's what we were told. It has to do with gas lines and gas and Qatar. I'll go into that in depth. Just to mention, New York is wonderful as a place for opportunity. And along the way, we meet some wonderful characters. And one of the characters I met early on was a man named Adam Purple. He went by different names. His actual name was David Wilkie, but he was known as Adam Purple, also Reverend Les Ego, and General Zen. He wrote a little book called Zentances. He was the one who helped be the leading light of the urban garden, the modern urban garden. He created the Garden of Eden, and he got a lot of publicity about it. He did a lot of good. He taught a lot of people, and a lot of people went on to create urban gardens because of him. Well, he has passed because of he was hit by, from what I understand, he was in a bike, and he died 84 years of age. They're going to have a service for him. And because he was so important, I want to let people in this audience know the memorial for Purple was planned for tomorrow between 5 and 8 p.m. at La Plaza Culture at the southwest corner of East 9th Street and Avenue C in New York City. That's La Plaza Culture at the southwest corners of East 9th and Avenue C. He was a character, and that brings me to this little piece. Organic food sales soar. Back then, you couldn't give organic food away. In fact, I took organic food from my farm upstate in Goshen to my buddy who founded Fairway, Dave, and Fairway actually offered the produce, organic, locally grown produce, at half the cost, 50% less than the sprayed pesticide-laden produce, and nobody would buy it. And he couldn't understand it, and I Now I realize it was the right idea, but at the wrong time. And the people weren't going to do something if they didn't trust it. Here's good news. From Echo Watch, Americans are increasingly hungry for naturally grown and healthier foods. And according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture statistics, organic farms are skyrocketing and consumers are up their sales 72% from 2008. So that's good news. And it's also good for people who'd like to start their own little home-based business and sell their organic produce to farmers market, food co-ops, and to health food stores. My guest is on the line now. She is Professor Lisa Miller. She is Professor of Clinical Psychology and Director of the Clinical Psychology at Columbia University's Teachers College. She is also the founder of the Spirituality Mind-Body Institute of Columbia and co-editor-in-chief of the Journal of Spirituality and Clinical Practice, published by the American Psychological Association. And for the past 20 years, she's been conducting scientific research on the integration of spirituality with the mental health and wellness of people. She's published 100 peer-reviewed articles on the subject. She has degrees from Yale University and a doctor from University of Pennsylvania. And her newest book is The Spiritual Child, The New Science of Parenting for Health and Lifelong Thriving. Her website is lisamillerphd.com. Nice to have you with us today.
Oh, it's absolutely wonderful to be here joining you on your show.
Good. Before we get into our topic, I just want to give a few of my thoughts after listening to Fox Network's multiple so-called experts on the Pope and his visit. First, I want to commend this Pope, because of all the different popes that at least have been around in my lifetime, this is the one that, to me, seems to have the strongest real commitment to change. He is asking people to reconsider their impact and the choices they make on global warming. He is asking them to pay attention to the fact that animals consume a lot of food that should go to humans. The ratio is 16 to 1, meaning 16 pounds of grain are eaten to create 1 pound of beef, so why not simply eat the 16 pounds of grain? But also, as a scientist, he has a master's degree in chemistry. So he's not just talking about someone who is the Holy See. He is talking from a scientific point of view. Methane from these 60 billion animals raised each year around the world, over 12 billion in the United States, are creating methane, and that methane contributes to 22 times more problems with global warming than does carbon dioxide. So, in my opinion, this Pope is a breath of fresh air and a departure from the regressive rules of his two previous predecessors. Now, his critics have been expecting him to make widespread and dramatic changes all at once, like on abortions, same-sex marriage, women priests, divorce. However, I see it differently. Just remember, the Catholic Church has been entrenched in extremely right-wing papal prohibitions and is facing a bureaucracy that is still fundamentally defined by Popes John Paul and Benedict. And remember, it was under Benedict and Paul that all this pedophilia happened and was hidden. Francis, on the other hand, is making extraordinary incremental changes that have already changed the face of the Catholic Church dramatically. And by the way, he is quite simply the most popular person on the planet. And of course, his encyclical on the environment and climate change are critical. He challenges free market capitalism. And who else does that? Do we have any of our political leaders do it? No. And he attacks the meat industry and the violence against animals. He sanctifies all life. And he's cleaning up the Vatican Bank, also known as the Institute for the Works of Religion. He is unflinching about financial corruption. When was the last time we had a politician, except for Ralph Nader, who was wanting to be elected but never was elected, who really had the courage to go up against all the corporate Democrats and corporate Republicans? He did it, but he did it in such a way that he did it with a sense of grace in his presentation. He's made more transparent the money laundering and secretive taxes that used to be going on. And he's risked being assassinated by the Italian mafia because they used to use the Vatican Bank as their own personal bank. It was totally corrupt. He has forced some of the most powerful bureaucrats, numbering 2,900 clerics, who indulge in the privileges of power and wealth and operate in the shadows of the secret Vatican finances, his what is called the Apostolic Exhortations. He wrote a 50,000-word statement in defense of the poor and global economic inequality and the excesses of free market capitalism. And he's made liberal statements accepting homosexuality and atheism. He has opposition to capital punishment and torture of any kind on anyone. And that's strong because he came from Argentina, which had a history of dictators and torturing, murdering people. He criticized his own church for being too obsessed with contraception and abortion. He cracked down on the bishops and the high clergy living lavish lifestyles, like the one German cardinal that spent $41 million, including a $20,000 bathtub. He got rid of him. Francis himself lives a very humble life. He lives in a simple room, and he does not engage in any of the traditional extravagant Vatican Palace chambers. And he created a synod that would reform church views on marriage, equality, and divorce. And while not trying to change family values outright, according to some old scriptural model, he has been talking with his bishops and getting them out there also. So I see good coming from this. I would suggest this, if he did nothing more than got every Catholic, and there's 1.2 billion, one-seventh of the world's population, to start weaning themselves away from meat or animals of any kind to a plant-based diet, think of how powerful that will be for the people's health, preventing disease, helping the planet, helping stop some of the global warming. That in itself would be one of the most remarkable achievements, because no one else in the world is going to do that. Those are my own thoughts on what I consider a remarkable human being. Now, to you, Dr. Miller.
Yes.
I'd like to begin with a large international study you performed with thousands of participants that looked at the role religion and spirituality played in the lives of people in China, India, and the United States, because I feel this is a good starting point. And what you discovered is that China and India, the better educated, were also the most successful, happy, and spiritual. However, this was not the case in the United States, where the opposite was more likely the case. Today, mental disorders are a scourge across college campuses, including your own. And there was a New York Times article earlier this year reporting on a survey of 150,000 college students that found 10% were clinically depressed, 35% or one-third overwhelmed with pressures, but managed to survive. Happiness and a deep sense of purpose in life and pursuing a future that is fulfilling is even more rare. And this is a serious health issue. It was the last large Pew survey found the percentage of Americans who are atheist or agnostic had jumped to 23% and is a larger growing trend among millennials, which is a 36%. So I feel this study you conducted is telling us something very important about what's going wrong in our postmodern society, and also about our hyper-scientific and rationalist mindset that has increasingly become reductionist and determinist. So please begin by sharing this international survey and why this discrepancy between these Asian countries and the U.S. were observed in your findings. The forum is yours.
Yes, well, thank you. That is indeed correct. So together with my lab, Clayton McClintock, Elsa Lau, we looked at thousands of people in China, India, and the U.S., and the first thing we asked is, what is the experience of universal spirituality? You know, whether or not a country is religiously oriented or a people is religiously oriented, what is essentially the phenotype of spirituality? And we knew there was indeed a phenotype, because for 15 years, twin studies have shown that natural spirituality is indeed innate, a capacity for transcendence, a sense of relationship to the transcendent life force, that is innate. So what is indeed this, you know, having documented with twin studies a heritable contribution, many labs across the country have documented this, a heritable contribution to spirituality, what does that look like? And what our team found was that there are five core dimensions all around the world to spiritual life, with or without religion. One is an awareness of the interconnectedness of all life, that we are not atoms bumping off each other, but that what we do indeed affects people, as you so beautifully put in your description of the Pope's global teachings right now. The second is that there is an ultimate call for altruism and care and kindness to fellow living beings. The third is that love is in and through the structure of the world. The fourth is contemplative practice or prayer, and the fifth is the reflective life, often, which does take hold in religion but can take hold outside of religion. These five components were found in people in China, in people in India, in people in the U.S. It may surprise people to learn that in China there was actually a higher level of natural spirituality expressed than in the U.S. Right? People often think that because a government doesn't allow religion or there's not freedom of religious speech that the people aren't spiritual, but natural spirituality was alive and well around the world. However, we did find that in China and in India, with greater education came a deepening and a strengthening of spirituality. But in the U.S., and the U.S. alone, the more educated people became, the less spiritual they became, and the more prone to depression. There are probably 100 articles in the clinical literature that show spirituality protects against depression. Spirituality can be the light out of depression. And yet, essentially, our educational system is set up right now to educate emerging adults out of spiritual life and into a dark tunnel of meaninglessness. There are some very core problems in our pedagogical structure, and the most central, I would say, is the disaggregation of head and heart, that students are taught to vigorously inquire with the head, but are not taught to reflect in such a way as draws upon the heart, to not ask a question of what is my meaning and purpose, but to bypass that for more outward, more pragmatic, more instrumental questions. And that in the long run has built about 1.5 generations lives without foundation, and we're raising a country of people who are robbed of a chance to use their education to look into the deepest and most important points of meaning.
One of your fundamental premises, which is based upon a large body of science, is that every child is born with an innate sense of spirituality. Now, many have commented on gazing into the eyes of an infant and observing an angelic quality in the countenance of the child. This is aura of awe or wonder or unconditional openness to the world outside the child, as if there is not a single thing that is awry or bad in our world today. Now, many of us strict scientific, secular, and atheistic view would argue against any science supporting your premise. So what would be the evidence you would provide to provide them with a different perspective? And also the science that indicates that a child's growing up in a family that supports and encourages spiritual values is more likely to develop positively and optimistically as they get older.
Yes, in the spiritual child, I reference close to 100 peer-reviewed scientific articles on the developmental path of spirituality in children and adolescents. Science is a lens. There is nothing unscientific at all about asking spiritual questions. Science is a method and a lens that can be applied to anything. It can be applied to questions of temperament, to questions of IQ, questions of health and wellness, and certainly questions of spiritual life. When we take our standard scientific methods and bring them to questions of spiritual life, we find, first and foremost, that every single person on earth is born a spiritual child. There is a heritable contribution to the capacity to experience spirituality. We know this starting in 1997. Ken Kendler published a landmark article in the American Journal of Psychiatry in which he showed that about one-third of the differences between people in spiritual life are attributed to heritability. He then replicated that 2 years later to respond to his critics to show that this natural capacity for spirituality exists independent of any type of personality. So it's not just that good guys are more spiritual or more open people or introverts are more spiritual. That's simply not the case. Spirituality exists onto its own as an innate human capacity. It can be embraced by religion. It can be cultivated by religion. But spirituality exists in our birthright with or without its cultivation through religion. Now, the child comes eminently spiritual, and when you describe the look of an infant, that is the look of a naturally spiritual human being.
All right. Final question. How important is a child's exposure to nature and being outdoors in a natural environment for its spiritual development? And why do you feel that there is an association between the natural world, which is essentially wordless and non-conceptual, and a sense of sacredness that a child can tap into more easily than an adult?
Yes, so that is absolutely the case. The child can experience and understand animals with an understanding that we are often socialized out of as adults. I thought your point was very well taken, that, you know, we terribly mistreat animals. It is, you know, if someone were to visit us from another planet, they would say there's a holocaust. There's a holocaust against living beings, those who we call animals. It is horrific the way we treat conscious, loving animals. If you look at a dog in the MRI, if you look at a cow in an MRI, they have the same neural correlates of love. They have real love. They have real compassion. And the mass mistreatment and murder of animals is horrific. Now, the child knows that the animal is conscious and can connect with animals, can talk with animals. And this natural spiritual awareness can be fostered. Children are born with a natural spiritual compass. If we do support natural spirituality in children, if we usher them through the first and second decade, giving them names for spiritual reality, honoring spiritual activism, such as you described from the Pope, what the science shows us, and this has been published in, you know, Journal of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, American Journal of Psychiatry, a teen whose natural spirituality is supported is 80% less likely to engage in risk-taking and be exposed to STDs, 60% less likely to be depressed, 40% less likely to be a substance abuser than the average teen, and 80% less likely than a teen low in spiritual life, which means that the child who's not supported in developing their natural spirituality is 80% more at risk for substance abuse. Spirituality is the hub of all other lines of development. And many of the character strengths and virtues, such as grit and optimism and persistence, go hand in hand. Really, they're sort of the blossoms on the tree of that which has its deep roots in spiritual life. About 20% of kids are virtuous humanists. They do not take spirituality as their hub. But 80% of children are. So even if a parent has absolutely no spiritual feelings and is a hardcore atheist, it is unfair to a child to ignore natural spirituality. The child may not match the parent, or vice versa. So just as we don't assume that our kids do math like us or take to music like us, we need to really be present and honor our child's natural spirituality, because that is the greatest resource for thriving and even the golden ticket for outward success. It's not 18 lessons on the cello. It's a sense of relationship to God or the higher being or the life force that's through us that becomes the source of kindness, charity, and even determination that helps a child later thrive.
Well, thank you very much for coming on. All the best with The Spiritual Child, the new science of parenting for health and lifelong thriving. The website is lisamerlertphd.com. Appreciate you being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Gary Noll. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day. You know I can be found sitting home.